Listed as one of the five worst international selections ever and described in a book about Scottish rugby as a fullback slower than your average prop, Ian Smith cheerfully won 8 caps for Scotland in a career that saw him score every point for his team in his on his debut in a victory over South Africa and defeated a star-studded England team to lift the Calcutta Cup at Murrayfield in 1970. A fullback slower than your average prop is the name of his autobiography. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, Ian Smith. Smith himself. Ian, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you.
Good to have you with us. It's a bit of an awful description, isn't it? One of the five worst international selections ever. Surely that's not fair.
Well, everybody is entitled to their opinion. At the time when I read it, it was pretty depressing. But when you look back sort of 40 years, it's actually rather funny. I was extremely fortunate to be picked for Scotland because I was actually in my club thirds one Saturday, and 2 weeks later I made my debut for Scotland. I was well enough known in Scotland, but I wasn't at all well known in England.
So how did you get into rugby itself? Where did it begin, and what was the team that you were playing in the thirds for?
Well, I got into rugby at my school, George Heriot's in Edinburgh, where rugby was a religion, and we actually ran 36 15s when I started playing rugby in about 1952-53 time. And I started in the 36 15, went through school, and then played for, I mean, George Heriot's produced 8 men who played fullback for Scotland, so it was kind of a fullback factory, and I couldn't make the former pupils first or seconds. I actually was playing for the thirds. Went to the university, and the university turned out to be a very good side. And when I graduated, I was in the army as a dentist and was posted eventually to the south of England, where I couldn't get into the London Scottish firsts because their fullback was a Scotland player. The second's fullback was the younger brother of a British Lion, so I was playing for the thirds. But I was also playing for the army and combined services, and that's how I got the chance to be picked for Scotland.
And what was your reaction then when you got the call-up? And you weren't just playing any old international team. You were playing the Box, which was an interesting team to be playing at that particular period in time.
Yes, because that was the apartheid tour of 69-70 when Peter Hain set up mass demonstrations against the Springboks. So it was a very unhappy tour for them. It was awesome to be picked. You know, if you play rugby, every child who plays rugby wants to play for their country. And suddenly I was getting this opportunity from out of the blue. So it was, it was unbelievable. I wasn't even aware of the problems over apartheid in South Africa because it wasn't, you know, I lived in Scotland, I lived in England. It wasn't something that anybody talked about. It was only when we played and afterwards that I began to realise what was happening.
And what was it like? What was the build-up like to that match? And how did you feel when you walked onto the hallowed turf?
It's very emotional. Hugely emotional. Even although the ground was half empty because the police had prevented people sitting, standing at either end. Murrayfield then was completely open, apart from a stand on one side. The terraces ran round the other three sides. And two of the three sides, the terraces were empty with just a police presence to stop anybody from getting in there and getting onto the pitch. So the atmosphere was very muted. But to come out, although I wasn't in a blue shirt, I was in a white shirt because we were playing South Africa and we were the home team. Nevertheless, it's a child's dream come true. So it was wonderful.
I mean, not only a child's dream come true, you were the hero of the day. You scored every, all the points, including a try.
Yes, but one would have to say that I missed 5 kicks at goal. And the general at that time in the Royal Army Dental Corps that I was in, he sent me a letter saying at half time I was going to be posted to Siberia. And then I managed to kick a penalty and then score a try and discovered, 20 years later, that was the first try scored by a Scotland fullback ever. in the history of international rugby.
Oh, wow. Quite an achievement. What was it like then? Because obviously we're coming to the end of a World Cup. Tomorrow is the big match. And we've seen these giants, these athletes running around at breakneck pace. Back in sort of the late 60s, things were a little bit different in terms of your own training regime.
Well, when I turned up on the Thursday afternoon, which was when the Scottish team met before the Saturday match, there were three players in the side I had never met. There was only one or two players that I'd ever played with, and the rest I had played against. And we had a three-hour session on the Thursday afternoon, and that was all the practice we had before we played South Africa.
And what was your training regime like? Were you doing the gym? Were you doing sort of long distance walks, or was it a bit more genteel?
Well, training back then, there was very little. In fact, there was no coaching at all, really. At London Scottish, you ran up and down the field and did press ups and things, but there was no gym work. I mean, it was totally different. It was a very amateur game. I mean, A very good friend said to me, you know, there's a sign above the centre court at Wimbledon which says, if, you know, I can't remember what it says now. It says something about, it's from If. But they said there was a sign above the door of the dressing room at Murrayfield which said, if at first you don't succeed, we'll find someone who can.
Ooh.
And, you know, that kind of thing kind of makes you worry a little.
But, I mean, you had a marvellous debut. Like I said, you scored all the points and a try. What was the next matchup? And did you then think that you were secure in your place then with the Scotland team?
Not at all, because prior to the next match coming along, I was now playing for London Scottish First, because they had the club policy that if you were a current internationalist, you played for the First. And I was not playing well at all, which was the time when the press began to say, and one of the pressmen said, if they could take international caps away, they should take Ian Smith's away, because he wasn't good enough in the first place, and he's certainly not good enough now. And the same pressman was the one who said I was one of the five worst international selections of all time. So then we played France, and I actually got a try against France, and became the first fullback in any country to get tries in his first two internationals, which I only found out about years later. But that was a very difficult time because, you know, you play well in international, but actually not very well in your club matches, and people begin to point the finger. So you can lose a bit of faith in yourself.
I mean, we talk about rugby now, and it's a multi-million pound business. You know, players are flying around the world, big sponsorship, huge TV rights. I mean, we talk of a more romantic era. How was the socialising? Or was it a case of literally after a match, you literally grabbed your duffel bag and headed back to London or wherever you were based?
Oh, no, there was a dinner after the match. And you normally sat with the players and with the opposition, and you would drink with them. There would be a players' room in the hotel that the team was staying in. When it was the Scottish Rugby Union, if you won, you got champagne. If you lost, you were lucky if you got a few beers. But no, there was a lot of fraternisation afterwards because you knew most of the guys you were playing against. It's not like that today.
And also,
it was a black tie dinner.
Also,
and a big evening.
Also, you played against the old enemy at Murrayfield, the Calcutta Cup. Now, England in 1970 were quite a force to be reckoned with. What were your memories leading up to that match and of the match itself?
Well, there was a programme on television on the Wednesday night in which they talked about the high ball, the up and under kick by the fly half, and they showed several instances of fullbacks getting absolutely annihilated under the high ball. And they said at the end of it, Ian Smith has never really been tested under the high ball, but he will on Saturday. And so I have to say I was sick fairly shortly after that, because that was absolutely terrifying. And they talked about the massive English centres. Actually, oddly enough, I was looking at a program recently. The English centres were less than 15 stones. They were sort of 14, 14 and a half stones. And they were described as massive. Now, if you compare to today, when Bastereau, France, is 23 stones playing in the centre. it's little wonder that the injury levels today are so much higher than they were when I played.
Indeed. So when you walked on at Murrayfield, obviously this time around, a full Murrayfield, all the emotion, the anthems going, the England team expected to win. What's going through your mind then, and what are your memories of the match?
Well, I was terrified because I knew they were going to kick the ball very high in the air. And the first scrum of the match, I think it was an England putter, and the entire English back division put the palms of their hands upwards and pushed them up and down with big grins on their face. So I knew what was coming. That was quite scary. Fortunately, I managed to catch the first one, and so they didn't try it again. We played very well as a team. Our forwards were fantastic, and we were able to beat England, not comfortably, but to beat them was great. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've played them once, and we won one. I won one, but Gregor Townsend said, I think he played 10 times against England and only won once. So, you know, how fortunate was I to be able to say that.
And what was it like lifting the Calcutta Cup at Murrayfield, having beaten the English?
Well, the presentation took place at the dinner afterwards, as far as I remember, and I managed to actually touch the handle, but there was nothing like there is today. It was such a beautiful trophy. I think it was really, they were very frightened that something would happen to it, so nobody was really allowed to touch it apart from the captain. In the next season, when we went to Twickenham and we beat England again, that was the match that I was dropped for.
And was that...
I remember watching that one on television.
And the match before that, had that been your final appearance, or did you get back in the side after the...
I actually went off to Hong Kong with the army. But I actually didn't just... I had this short spell where... Suddenly I was dropped by Combined Services, the Army, Scotland, and then I got a phone call from London Scottish saying, now you're not good enough for Scotland, I'm afraid you're in the seconds on Saturday. So I kind of did the circle of getting picked for Scotland from a lower team, getting dropped by Scotland, and ending up back in a lower team again.
What was
that? Natural justice.
Did you think at that point, oh, for goodness sake, I might as well pack it all in then, or is you just love the game and you'll play it, you know, at any level?
I went to Hong Kong. I was lucky enough to captain Army Hong Kong, and even luckier to play for Hong Kong in the Asian Rugby Games. And I actually have 4 caps for Hong Kong. I've just been there to collect my Hong Kong international cap and played against Japan twice.
And what was the Asian rugby scene like over there in Hong Kong then in the early 70s?
Well, it was very much, there were only really 3 good teams in Hong Kong. There was the police, the Hong Kong Football Club, and the army. But when I was in Hong Kong 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, there are now 6 professional teams, and Hong Kong came very close to qualifying for the World Cup. So the standard is quite different now to then. But it was great fun to play then, and I was lucky enough then to come home and sort of gradually go back down through teams without any pressure and enjoying playing junior rugby, which doesn't seem to happen anymore. And I think I'm very privileged to have been able to do that.
I mean, anybody, if you ask them, any player of any level to represent your country is obviously, you know, the highest accolade you can have. You must look back on your career and go, well, you know, 8 Scotland caps, scored all the points against South Africa. If you're going to take some victories, then, you know, beating England and the Box is quite a good one to have on your wall.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, now I look back in wonderment, really. I occasionally go on, you know, Paffy News when I can get it up on my computer and I've got the tries and I can look at them when I'm having a bad day and it makes a bad day better.
Why did you decide then to write the book, and what were you trying to get across? Is it the way that rugby's changed, the attitude of the players, and just the sort of the fun you had?
Well, the absolute truth of the matter is that my wife, Julie, who is sitting next to me as I'm speaking to you, had found all the press cuttings that my father lovingly collected over the years. And she said to me, you didn't tell me about this. And I'm not going to remember to tell your sort of grandchildren, because I'm a bit older than she is. so you better write it down. I think you should tell your story. So I wrote everything down, and I was very lucky that Berlin publishers in Edinburgh felt that it was a useful and interesting story, a story about rugby that doesn't exist anymore.
Indeed.
You know, rugby from 1953 to 1983, really. It's a long forgotten world.
I mean, what was it like revisiting those press cuttings and looking through and seeing some of the people you played with and played against?
It's very interesting. It's actually a very difficult thing to do, to write and be truthful about your past, because you can't just write about the good things. You have to write about perhaps the things you're not so proud of, and things that happened that you had no control over, because I think it's important to be honest. And I wanted it to be my story written by me. I didn't want to have somebody help me do it.
And what was the toughest opponent then? I mean, on your Test career, who was the player that you looked across and thought, "Oh, blimey"? Was it the box? Was it that England team in the Calcutta Cup in 1970? What was the team or the opponent that made you have a little bit of a sort of maybe a Hail Mary moment before you left the changing room?
Well, that would be Wales, wouldn't it? As Wales were the dominant side. They had Gareth Edwards and Barry John and JPR Williams, Marvin Davis. They were just a fantastic side. Gerald Davis, who actually scored a try on the corner flag that I'm probably best remembered for, because I missed Gerald Davis when he scored the try, and then John Taylor kicked the conversion from the touchline that beat us, and it's still the greatest conversion since St. Paul on the road to Damascus. And I'm probably remembered for missing that tackle, though in truth, I never really got within 5 yards of him. But the camera angle made it look as if I was a lot closer. In fact, I saw him in South Africa a number of years ago and went up and said, "Gerald, you won't remember me. My name's Ian Smith, but I never got close enough to you for you to recognize me again."
It must have been...
So Wales, undoubtedly, were the side then.
A legendary team in the 70s. It must have been quite a feeling walking out there. Was that at the Elms Park, presumably, or was it back at Murrayfield?
No, that particular game was at Murrayfield, but at the Elms Park was the day that my first son was born, so that was quite tricky.
Yeah, I can imagine, because, yes, that must have been a very interesting conversation before you headed off to Cardiff.
No, in fairness, my late wife Maureen was perfectly happy for me to go. She was actually staying with an Irish internationalist called Mick Molloy, who was a lovely second row forward who was also in the army. And so he was a doctor, and so she stayed with him, not thinking that actually that Saturday morning Simon would appear. And so I got a phone call at breakfast saying, "You've just become a father."
Did you think that affected your game at all, or do you think you were always going to have a bit of a tussle against that Welsh side?
Well, all I can really remember about the game was afterwards, because that was 1970, and I found myself sitting next to John Dawes, who was to become the Lions captain, and the first thing he said to me was, "We have a baby's head to wet," and so I lost 2 or 3 hours of my life that night. I can't imagine where it went.
I mean, this is one of the things about perhaps you're lucky to be playing in that age, because obviously the dark arts that go on both on the pitch and off the pitch these days would be recorded by everybody on social media. And back in the 70s and the 60s, you could sort of get up to some hijinks without being relatively found out.
Yes, I think that's true. Of course, I never took any part in any of these hijinks.
But of course not.
Yes. It's a completely different world. It's a world where, the press effectively picked the international team, because in order for a selector, and there were selectors then in all the countries, the Big Five used to be called, in order for you to be watched by the selectors, you had to get good press. And there was, television only covered internationals, so... You know, if club teams invented moves, and Edinburgh University side I played in was the first team in the world to use the miss moves, which are now commonplace. And nobody knew what was happening because there was no television. There was nobody scrutinizing what you were doing. There were just things written in the papers. And if you played well enough, the press would said you played well enough, the selectors would come and watch, and if you played well enough, you'd get picked for the trials, and if you played well enough, you'd get picked to your country. But you would go from playing in front of, in my case, London Scottish thirds, three men and a dog, to going out in front of millions on television. And that doesn't happen now. People go up through the grades, bigger and bigger crowds. They play for the club, then they play in a European Cup match. Then they play for the country and probably come on as a sub for the last 15 minutes. And then they start a game. So they're quite used to it. In my day, it was quite different.
Indeed.
To actually come out in front of a massive crowd.
And of course, we're in the end of the World Cup. It's not been a brilliant World Cup for Scotland, has it? What's your thoughts on, did you see any of the Scotland matches, and what are your thoughts on where Scotland goes from here?
Well, actually, I read an amusing article which said that the Scottish Rugby Union was suing the Japanese Rugby Union because I think it was false pretenses, you know, that they'd conned us into being an awful lot better than we thought they were, which I thought was quite funny. To be honest, I don't know. There was an article in The Scotsman last week which said Scotland needs another professional club, not just two big sides. They need three, because Scotland are picking from less than 100 people for their international teams. And if you compare that to England, it is little wonder that we don't win many matches. Mm.
The book is called A Fullback Slower Than Your Average Prop. It's by Ian Smith. It's out now on Arena Sport. Ian, do you do the social media thing? Can they people find you on the web or anything like that?
If you actually put in A Fullback Slower Than Your Average Prop, then how to buy the book will come up through Watterson's or W.H. Smith's, and there are a lot of other outlets.
And do you still keep up with your rugby? I mean, are we to find you on the touchline or watching a game every now and again? What, you know, do you still keep in touch with your former?
I have a local club called West Norfolk where I actually played my last game for their seconds many years ago, and I have coached the club and been director of rugby. But right now, I mean, I'm 75 years old. I'm very much just a spectator now, and probably like most people of my age, a mutterer about how things aren't the way they used to be. They were much better 30 years ago.
The book is called A Fullback Slower Than Your Average Prop. It's out now on Arena Sport. It's by Ian Smith. Ian, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me. And you're a very easy man to talk to. Thank you.
Pleasure is all mine.